Hi Maureen, welcome.
Oh, hi, hello.
So Maureen, before we start the talk, this is the get to know the speaker section.
All right. So,
so actually I'm going to ask you a question that we haven't discussed. And the question is, what's the thing that has brought you the greatest joy in your life?
Oh my goodness. There have been many things. Actually, I feel very lucky that, of course, I've had ups and downs like everybody else. But I have had a lot of love in my life. And I think that because I've had love shown to me and care shown to me, it's quite natural to want to show that love and care towards others. And so I think that has brought me a lot of happiness. And, you know, that has, you know, that relates to family. That, and yes, lucky to have a close family. That relates to the people that I interact with and work with.
Mm-hmm.
And it relates to when also I'm doing things that are more public, because I'm always aware that people respond to the vibe or the atmosphere that you give out. And of course, that can't be an artificial thing. It has to come from within, from the heart. And so, yes, I think these are the things that have inspired me. And so it's hard to think of one particular thing in that sense. And of course, there have been peaks, certainly when interesting, we've been showing some webcasts and going into the archives of events that have been organized in the past. And last night we showed an event that happened in 1997 at the Royal Albert Hall. And I was very much involved in, I guess, producing that and of course working with many, many others. But I then remembered that night, and by that time, of course, you're not involved hands-on. That's all been sorted, so they say. And I remember sitting in the box and looking and thinking that, you know, the people on the stage are just very, very happy this evening.
Mm-hmm.
And I could feel that atmosphere was then penetrating into the whole audience. And I thought, yeah, this is good. This is a high moment, really. Yeah,
wow.
I enjoyed that. Yes.
You've traveled the world.
Quite a few places, yes.
Quite a few places. And I know that you love India, without doubt, because you go back at least a couple of times a year.
Yeah, usually twice a year. Sometimes it's been more, but
yeah. At least twice a year, if not more.
Yeah.
So other than India, in your travels, which country have you been to that's really touched your heart and why?
Well, I suppose actually Israel probably is the place, because that's part of my background, being from that, from the Jewish religion, and I have family there. So I've always felt, I didn't really feel. It's interesting to think about how you kind of feel a connection to somewhere. Like with India, it was like something in the back of my mind, because actually my parents were married in Calcutta, and so we were hearing stories of India from our childhood. And I remember in school once, we were asked the question, where would you like to go if you could go somewhere? And it was almost involuntary. I said, India, not with any thought, not imagining how much I would travel to India. And so it really touched me. But now I know you're asking about another place, and I think it was similar with Israel. It was always there in the atmosphere and in the environment. And and I've had uncles there since the 50s, and my sister emigrated there in 1983, and so I think I went there before that. But I was very curious to connect with something of my ancestry. But of course, the place that touched me a lot, and it would be so for anybody who goes there, is Jerusalem. It's such a beautiful city, but you feel the history, the how ancient it is. And I remember, you know, of course, that place, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the Temple Mount, the Via della Rosa, all those, you know, amazing, the wall, of course, all those amazing places. And I've been there with spiritual leaders, mm-hmm. Religious leaders, and it just felt so important to come together in that land. But just being there made me think about how important it is to stay with things that are deeper for you, you know, not to live on the surface, but live with more depth, in other words, of what, you know, really is meaningful in life. So I've enjoyed those visits very much. And then, of course, connecting with family, because my sister now has 7 grandchildren over there. So wow. I have 7 great nephews and nieces. In fact, only 1 niece, the rest are all boys. but there's one set of twins, non-identical, brother and sister, and they're so delightful. So it's always a delight going there and connecting. That place did touch me. And I think other travels in the Far East too. I think I've always been more attracted to the East in a way, although I've traveled, of course, all over. Something has to touch your heart, doesn't it?
Is there something in particular about the East that touches your heart?
It seems, I don't know what to say. I was going to say it seems so mystical in a way. The whole, you know, of course, there is, you know, so much that's going wrong in all countries. And if you look at that side of things, and the poverty and the corruption everywhere, there can be, you know, you can feel that distress, mm-hmm. and you see that distress, and you feel that there has to be something, you know, whatever little you can do that can help alleviate that, you want to do. But it's like as if you feel that's a layer on top of something else, and it's obscuring the real beauty of the place. And you know, especially I've read a lot about India and about the freedom struggles and about how India was before the British Raj, and then, you know, even before that, the whole history. And you know, that ancient India, you feel, is so, you know, must have been so powerful or so amazing to be in that time, because there were so many discoveries of science and, you know, the way people lived with values and with real honor and with goodness. Mm-hmm. So there's always that. It's like as if it's seeping through, and that's what touches me. That's what I like to tap into.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Now, India, the other side of the world, and just very quickly, Calcutta, you mentioned.
Yeah. Had a cyclone recently.
Yes, they've just had a cyclone. We're on the other side of the world. And in a sense, there's a level of lockdown that's there. So we can't rush over with bandages, etc., to help them.
Yeah.
But what can we do sitting at home? Is there something?
Of course, in the physical sense, not a lot. And I've seen too that often when people try, even now that's not so easy, but when people try to physically send things, it's not always that which is needed. You know, it's always this thing of, am I doing something because it's my need, or is it really the need of the other people? So that too has its own parameters. But I also feel that it's important not to have a sense of pity and distress, but to actually have a sense that if I have in my mind a really powerful vision that there can be something better for the people there, that's, you know, you could say it's good wishes or pure thoughts, but it really is a powerful vision of something better. Then I feel that creates an atmosphere that actually can reach across distance and time and space. And that's amazing. I remember being involved in a project in the 80s, and we collected minutes of peace. And it was meant to be 1,000,000 minutes. People could contribute through prayer, through meditation, through just good thoughts. And it was around that time, just after that, that all the changes happened in Europe. The Berlin Wall came down, the, you know, massive changes, as we'll remember. And the person who chaired that, he was a member of the House of Lords, he was being interviewed, and the person, it was a radio interview, and the person said to him, "Do you mean to say that you attribute all these changes?" In fact, it was meant to be 1,000,000 minutes. We collected over 1 billion. In other words, people really gave their energy to this. And the interviewer said to him, "Do you really mean to say that all these changes are a result of all these minutes of peace?" And his response was, "Well, how can you say it wasn't?" But there you go. You know, and I do feel that as much as things are going haywire in the world, we have to keep up some sort of measure of a vision and of good feelings. Otherwise, if we get caught up in all the negativity that's happening, it's like we also become part of the problem, and it's very difficult to see a solution, even a physical solution, when it presents itself. So it's not being, it doesn't matter. No, not that at all. It's deep understanding and a love and a very deep feeling of generosity of heart, that there has to be something that's possible. I don't know if there's time for one little story related to that.
Go ahead.
Okay, and it was related to India at the time of the Bhuj earthquake, and that was quite devastating. And people who had everything, the next day suddenly they have to ask for a plate of food. Now, I mean, it's very, very hard to lose such a feeling of a loss of dignity. And some of the people belonging to the Brahma Kumaris, the organization is quite large in India. And they had gone out to the affected areas to give actually means for cooking some dry things, beans and lentils and whatever, rice, plus the cooking stoves and the fuel and so on. And when they were reporting back, and I heard one of these reports, one of the people said, and she was a doctor actually, she said, "Somebody commented to us that when you people come to us, we don't feel that we lose our dignity when you're giving to us." And I just thought that was so telling, because the attitude with which you do something is so important. And so if you feel you're giving a handout to somebody who needs it, well, yes, it's a kind of pity. But if you feel that humanity is my family, and so this is a family member, a brother, a sister, whatever, you're giving with a very different awareness. You're sharing rather than giving. You're sharing what you have. And I think that spirit is very helpful. And I think that really touched me and helped me to understand the importance of the spirit behind what you're doing, or the awareness behind what you're doing.
We have 1 minute, and I'm going to ask you this one question.
Okay.
Even though you've been to Israel and you have that deep connection with it, you're Jewish, but you were born in this country.
Yes.
So you're a northern girl. Can't hear it in your accent. Is that right?
Yeah. I'm from Liverpool. Yes.
So what's the best thing about Liverpool?
Oh, people are so friendly there. People would just go out of their way to do anything for you. And and so, you know, if you don't know the way, they won't just say go over there. They'll say, "Come on, I'll get in the car, I'll lead you there to the right turning," and they'll take you. Or if you're stuck, you know, in the snow or something. It happened to me once in London, and everybody drove past. And it wasn't the days of mobile phones. And I thought, if I was in Liverpool, there'd be 10 people queuing up to push me out. Although I shouldn't make generalizations. You have kindness everywhere, of course. But really, Liverpool is a very friendly city, and I really enjoy, I don't go back there that often now, but, you know, that's the main thing I would say.
So you brought a bit of Liverpool friendly to London. Thank you.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, so I'm going to welcome people as you're coming online now slowly. This is Maureen Goodman, and Maureen's going to be sharing on tonight's topic, which is feeling overwhelmed with all the juggling in life at the moment. Maureen, I've known for a number of years, and it's been a pleasure of interacting and working alongside or underneath as somebody being mentored by Maureen. The interesting thing is, she often seems like, you know, the analogy of a swan. They're floating along, very graceful, but the feet are paddling away at a whole different pace. I can say that, yes, Maureen's one of those people. She's definitely paddling away because she's got so many things to juggle. But on the surface, there is that pristine, swan-like feeling that you get from her.
How did you suss it out?
Well, having worked with you a little, I've realised just how much you juggle and have to juggle on a daily basis. Yeah. So I'm going to say to you, does juggling have to be a struggle, or can you enjoy it? And if by chance you have ever lost that sense of calm and felt a little bit overwhelmed by what life is throwing at you, what are your techniques to come back to that calm? So over to you, Maureen.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for that nice introduction. And you have to be paddling away to have success in life. I do believe that you do have to be proactive in life. Things are not just going to come to your doorstep. And yes, I was thinking a lot about juggling, because even though it's this period of lockdown, and in the UK, of course, things are starting to ease just a little. And so if you're part of an organization and people are coming back to, well, volunteer in this case, of course, that involves a lot of juggling of what are the safeguards, what are the guidelines, how you communicate. So a lot of things going on, and the rest of the work is still there as well. So yes, for some, I know they've really had time to just reflect and to do lots of things that they haven't done before, clearing out the clutter, etc. But I don't think it's quite come to that for me as yet. Maybe it will. But you know, when you do juggling, of course, you need that dexterity, you need a lot of concentration, you need calm, you need to be very much with yourself, I feel, rather than totally extended into the action and caught up in it. And I'll explain more about that, because of course, when the juggling is going well, then it's easy. If you watch a juggler, it flows, you know, it looks absolutely effortless. And once you get onto a roll of success, it is effortless. But the problem is when you drop a ball, when something does go wrong, and of course it will. It's just the nature of life, just the nature of things. And that's the point at which you need to know what your methods are to pick yourself up and to move on and to make the best of things. But of course you have to get to that flow in the first place as well. And there are different ways in which I've worked with myself to get to that. And as I say, I drop the ball sometimes, definitely, and you think, what am I going to do now? I was talking with somebody a few days ago, And she was getting herself quite stressed about things. And it's been going on for a little bit of time. And so we had a good talk. And we identified three things that were causing the stress. When there's a task in front of you, these responses, these three responses. Firstly, the thought that I have to do it immediately. That causes stress. Secondly, the thought that I have to do it perfectly. That causes stress. And thirdly, the thought that I have to do it in a way that does not draw criticism from other people. That causes stress. And so we looked at these attitudes, and as we talked it through, she could see, and it was good for me too, that stepping out of these attitudes can help us to be more calm and to take things more steadily in a way that isn't going to cause stress. And the interesting thing is that when we jump to do things too quickly, and we keep going at that sort of pace, finally, we often get less done. I've discovered that moving carefully with patience is often much more productive because I'm much less likely to drop the ball. So first, this thing of feeling that I have to do it immediately. And often people pressure you. You know, the DYGME syndrome. I'm sure you all have it. I have it. Did you get my email? Someone sent you an email, and then half an hour later, an hour later, did you get my email? Well, hold on. Yes, I got your email, but I may have got 50 other emails as well. And there seems to be this drive, you know, this prevailing atmosphere. Things have to be done immediately. But do they? And I've begun to learn that, yes, you want to do things at the right time and you want to do them well, but you don't necessarily have to jump to do it immediately, because often then you haven't put that thought and consideration into it. And I know I would talk about the tyranny of emails. And what did we do? Oh, I met somebody today, and I have to send some guidelines to people when they volunteer. And I was asked to give him this by hand. And I said, well, do you not have an email address? I have, but I don't really use it. And I asked him, do you have a business or anything? He said, yes, I'm in construction. I said, you don't use your email? Not really. I thought, oh, this is a person to admire. And we get so, you know, overwhelmed by these things. But let me step back. Maybe there's another way I can do things, not necessarily without the emails, but another approach to things. And this made me think quite a bit, you know, when I get into this situation or I think I have to do it immediately. I say to myself, why am I being ruled by time? And what is time to me? What is my relationship with time? And can I make it a relationship where time is there at my disposal? It's not forcing me. Because what is it? It's a question of how I use my time, isn't it? And I remember somebody once telling me a story, and they had been brought up in a village in India, and their mother used to sew those beautiful, colourful skirts and sell them. And he and his brother were getting a good education, and they were going to be getting jobs. And they said to their mother, because she would do everything by hand, and they said to their mother, well, you know, soon we'll be earning some money. We can buy you a sewing machine and it will save you time. And she looked at them and said, time, save me time. What do you mean? Time is in front of me. Time is there for me to use. And when I heard that story, that really made me reevaluate my own relationship with time. And I thought, yes, it's up to me how I use my time. And so if you think about juggling, you have to be the master in order to juggle. And so being, if you like, the master of time, I mean, that sounds very grand, but in the sense of knowing how you wish to use your time and consciously doing that really makes a big difference. And within that, I know how important it is to take pauses from time to time. And, you know, we don't reflect enough. I always feel this. Our societies are not reflective enough. And maybe this time of lockdown, for some anyway, has given a bit more time for reflection. And, okay, then I can see things a little more clearly. I know that if I pause before doing something, it really helps me to understand clearly what is the best thing to do, and especially before taking decisions that are important. A pause really helps. And at one point, somebody who's mentored me for many, many years and has only just passed on, working with her, she would not allow you to rush into anything. She would achieve a huge amount during the day, but she didn't want to rush because she kept her own mind very calm and purposeful. And I would go to her with a question, but we need to solve this, and what do I do? And I'd be a little bit, you know, need to do it now. And she'd say, just wait. But, you know how it is, just wait. And eventually I learned the wisdom of just wait. Wait for a moment, pause, reflect. Because then I could see that the decision and the action became a lot more productive. So these are lessons I've definitely learned along the way. This other thing of feeling that I need to have perfection. We don't live in a perfect world at this moment, and we are going to make mistakes. There are many factors that won't allow there to be perfection in everything that I do. And so I have to become comfortable, learn to become comfortable with my own mistakes. And I've had to learn this because we all do make mistakes. And the thing is, we may make even a little mistake and we really feel quite, you know, we turn in on ourselves and we feel that, you know, there's a kind of loss of self-worth because of that mistake. And we feel that we're a failure. And if you look at the way our society is set up at the moment and our education system in particular, in the conventional sense, it's like you're not allowed to fail. You have to have success and it has to be quantifiable. And for many individuals, success is something quite different and can't be quantified in the same way. They may not be academic. They may have very different talents. So we need to be allowed to fail. And often we feel bad about something, but often other people have not really noticed it. It's more in my head than in the heads of others. And so my whole journey with mistakes, and sometimes it would take me days, now it doesn't take me days, usually minutes, maybe an hour, but usually minutes. I get over that regret. Why? By asking myself a question, two questions actually. What do I learn What can I learn through this mistake? Or what have I learned through this mistake? And that really gives me a lot of empowerment, because then I can see it as something I can learn from and move on from. What have I learned? How has there been benefit for me? And sometimes when you stand back, and this has happened to me often, sometimes the mistake has turned out better than if I'd done it as I intended. It's a funny thing, but if you look back, you'll probably, have an experience of that in your life. But the important thing is dealing with those inner negative feelings that come when you do drop the ball. And it is going to happen. I wish I could sit here and say to you, well, if you do A, B, C, oh, there'll be perfection. It's not like that. It's more about how do I respond to the imperfection in myself and in others. And of course, this brings us on to the next thing, this thing of not wanting to draw any criticism from others. We feel fearful of criticism. Puts us into a, makes us anxious. Well, let's look at that a little bit. Nobody likes criticism, of course. But again, where is it coming from? When I criticize someone, and I'm sure we all do this at some point, when I criticize someone, where is it coming from? Is it really about criticizing them, or is it to do with some frustration in me? And can I develop more understanding and help the situation? I've learned to accept criticism and not take it so personally, and not allow myself to be defined by it. And this is the problem. Somebody says something negative to me, and I believe that that is me. But that's one person's perspective. And of course, what gets criticized is the ego or the arrogance, you know, this feeling that I've been insulted. If I really can develop my true self-worth of myself as a person, as a being, then I won't feel the insults so much, because I will have inner strength and resilience, because I will know my strengths, I will know my qualities, I will know my talents, I will know my values, I will know what it is I want to give to life. And if we get thrown off course by criticism, it's because we've been taking. Life is forgiving, not for taking. That's what I say. Of course, we accept it's a give and take and an exchange. But on that level of being who I am, I need to be myself, not taking my identity from here and there and from people's comments. Unfortunately, let me just give an example. I remember somebody, very experienced person, was asked a question in a talk. I was present. And the question she was asked was, what would you do if somebody stood up in a, you know, in front of other people and accused you of something? Not a very pleasant situation. And she said, well, if really I'd done something wrong, I would apologize. And if I hadn't done anything wrong, I would ignore it. And I thought, that's an answer with self-respect, with dignity, without ego or arrogance. I know who I am. I know my truth. Okay, let me respond accordingly. And think what happens very much in today's world is that we get very caught up in the doing and we forget about the being. Can I begin to reflect and understand more about the being behind the doing? I was just thinking of an example. You know, we have so many gadgets now that do thinking for us, don't we? And when you go on a journey, you know, and I do this, you put on the sat nav, tells you to turn right, turn left, go straight. Very easy. You don't need to think. You just need to follow. And if you're as old as me, you'll remember the time when we used to use road maps and street maps. And sometimes you'd have to stop the car, look at where you are, find it on the map, see your destination, figure out where you had to go for the next little bit. You actually saw something of the direction and you focused on your journey. And if I use that analogy totally in life, when we get so caught up in the doing, we don't see our destination. We only see what's immediately in front of us. We fail to see the bigger picture. And if we think about what's happening with humanity itself, now I think it's interesting because the world has been working in one direction with a virus that has affected all the countries. And of course, many perspectives and opinions about it, but I don't need to go into that. But we are where we are, and certain actions have been taken. And now people are beginning to reevaluate, where are we going? What is next? Which is interesting. So perhaps, are we starting a new journey? It would be wonderful if the world were to do that. But just in terms of my own life, can I see the bigger picture of my journey and my destination? And in that journey, when we reflect on what is really meaningful to us. At the end of the day, what is it that will give us comfort and happiness? And we know our relationships, our generosity of spirit, serving others, kindness, compassion. All these things are what give us inner strength and inner joy. And they actually are very natural to human life. We have got so distracted away from these very core qualities. And when I do reflect and I do pause, I also can see that there's a well of peace inside for me to tap into. And I can also tap into an inner wisdom, that still small voice within, that can really guide me in the right way. And there's a trajectory, a very interesting trajectory of awareness, vision, attitude, and, sorry, wrong order, awareness, attitude, vision, and action. Now, if my awareness of myself is that I'm a person who's not good enough, person who's always trying to prove themselves, a person who's struggling, what will be my attitude towards myself? A person who's always trying to please others, we get into that syndrome. My attitude towards myself is not going to be a positive one. It'll be difficult to have that self-esteem and that inner dignity. And then what would be my vision? My vision of the world will be, well, everybody's trying to put me down. That's what I'll see and that's what I'll experience. And my actions, I'll be very defensive, maybe even angry. If my awareness of myself is that I have a well of peace inside, I have inner wisdom, I have inner strength, I have that quality of compassion, I have things within me as a person that are really meaningful to me, then my attitude towards myself becomes a lot more positive. And then through that, my vision of the world is that, well, what can I do? How can I help? How can I understand? I will develop that generosity of spirit, and I will bring others with me, and I will feel that experience that cooperation. And then my action, of course, will be accordingly. So our awareness of how we see ourselves is really important in this. And then even though there are many things to juggle, I don't lose sight of who I am. And that keeps me centered. That keeps me calm. That keeps me concentrated so that the juggling can happen. But I am not the juggle. I am me. And so I don't struggle with the juggle. I like that. But I actually am patient with the juggle. Maybe I even enjoy it. But just one other aspect of that, which I think is really helpful and I found very helpful. It's important to do one thing at a time. Now, yes, we speak about multitasking, but really to do things well, you have to focus. Just this morning, somebody had asked me to speak to somebody about something. And I said, yes, I'll do that. About half an hour later, they said, have you spoken to so-and-so? I said, well, not yet, because I had this to do, then I had this to do, and now I will go to speak to the person. So I was quite clear that I had to take everything step by step. And whatever I do, let me do it with focus and let me do it well. And then actually you'll have a very economical use of time, and you'll have time to do the next thing and the next thing. And of course, that requires being present. And we talked about seeing the bigger picture and, in a sense, stepping back and seeing the whole trajectory. So this isn't about being present in terms of being caught up, but it's about being present to understand the need of the time, what I have to do, how I have to do it, and to understand where, what has brought me to this point, and what will be the consequences of my actions in the future. So it's like I have a breath of awareness while being in the present. If ever you've been for an eye test, you know, they give you this test of peripheral vision. So you're focusing on something, but they keep putting lights, you know, then you have to spot them. It's a bit like that. I'm here, I'm present, but my awareness extends so that I can understand as a whole what it is that I need to do. And then you find more and more. Of course, it takes time. It's not something you do instantly. It's like a training for the self, if you like. More and more, you do things at the right time, in the right way. And timing is another thing that's important. And I know myself, we all procrastinate at times. And then I do something when it's a bit too late and it feels very difficult. You know that if you'd done it at the right time, would have been had a very different result. Timing's important, and being able to do things at the right time and not allowing the mind to go into all those excuses as to why you can't do it when it's a need. I have to catch that thought. You need the clarity of thought. And so thoughts, very important in all of this. When my thoughts become negative, I literally lose my energy. I become tired. And if you go to sleep with worries, do you wake up refreshed? No. I have to pay attention to my mind and make my mind my best friend. Imagine. Because thoughts are my creation. I'm creating my thoughts. Or am I allowing my thoughts to be dictated to by whatever I see and hear around me? This brings us to a point of conscious choice in our lives. And so as I'm juggling, I'm not losing my awareness. I'm not losing my sense of choice. But I'm doing what I'm doing very consciously. And that's where perhaps you can see the swan paddling away, doing what's necessary, but there isn't necessarily distress visible, because it doesn't have to be distress. Doing, being active, great. Getting distressed, not so great. Getting stressed, not so great. And it all depends upon how I relate to myself, my task, the people around me, how I relate to them, and my relationship is through my thinking. Thinking positively brings one kind of relationship and interaction. Thinking negatively brings another kind of relationship and interaction. And so it's very important to understand the power of our thoughts. Very often we dismiss it, but I think more and more people are beginning to realize that thoughts do carry power. If you have a particular thought and you think about it, if I get angry about something inside, I have thoughts of anger, thoughts of frustration, eventually it's going to burst out into my words and my actions. And it may have pent up inside me for a long time. I have wasted a lot of energy in that. And I've not been creative. Sometimes you get an inspiration. It's a thought. It can be a half a thought even. But it inspires you. And it can lead to many beautiful things. Because you've caught a very good positive energy that you can then bring into your life. So the power of our thought is really important. And that's why it's important to take time to reflect, to be with the self. Otherwise, I don't really ever know the power that I have inside, the resilience I have inside, the creativity I have inside, and the possibility I have inside. And of course, people react differently to the same situation, don't they? So what does it tell you? There is a different person in each one. So who am I? What is my uniqueness? And what is it that I have to do? So I think over the years for me, having become more centered in myself and not allowing the external things, you know, as I say, people's criticisms, or even you can say the doing, the task, the profession, to define me. I'm bigger than that. Over time, understanding that has really helped me to keep that center in the midst of the juggling. And it is very interesting that the more you keep that center, the more you keep that calmness, often the more balls come into your hands. I've seen that. Another one? Okay. But you don't get, phased out by it. Because you know, as you do things, your capacity grows. It's very natural. But if you run away from things, well, the capacity is going to shrink. So these are some thoughts on juggling. And let us enjoy the juggle, do our best, and and also learn, constantly learn. I think that's very, very important. Life is for learning. Okay, thank you very much. So let us take time to reflect and practice that pause and see the power of our thoughts. So I take a few moments to be with myself. Let me have the courage to take my thoughts away from people, situations, things I've done or haven't done. Let me give my mind a rest from all those whirlings that often go on. And let me be myself. What would I like to think about myself? Who do I truly understand myself to be? Can I go inside instead of outside? If I go inside, I ask myself two questions. What is really meaningful for me? What do I value the most? What brings me real happiness? A happiness that takes me away from any inner conflict. What is meaningful? You will have your own answers. But we know that the world and every human being needs universal things that are meaningful. And what are those? Peace. In different ways, everyone is seeking peace. Love. In different ways, everyone is seeking love. Truth. In different ways, everyone wants to know what is real and what is true. And so, where do I look? Can I find them inside myself? They are part of my being. They are who I am. Realizing this very meaningful part of me, which is real, which is true. I value myself. And as I come into activity, this is the self that begins to act. I bring the being into the doing, and life becomes different, meaningful, productive, and I can share the joy that I feel inside with others around me. Thank you.
Thank you, Maureen. Thank you, Maureen.
Thank you.
Okay, the first question. It's really well written, so let's hope I can read it correctly. Thanks so much for the presentation. The idea of not responding to criticism and being centered makes perfect intellectual sense. But I think you know what the question is. But in the moment, criticism can strike.
Yeah, go on. But finish reading what?
Hello. But in the moment, criticism can strike viscerally, and it's difficult to control a response or even think at all. How do we get to a state where we can respond without letting the emotion take over?
Very good question. $64,000 question. Well, one word is practice. You know, just as we had this practice now, a very brief reflection, meditation, it took us into another dimension, essentially, another awareness of the self. And so that awareness is something that we need to build up. At the moment when criticism is in front of me, it's very difficult, as you're pointing out, to suddenly stay calm and it doesn't matter. So I have to be prepared and I have to build up that awareness. And I know that's what's happened for me because I've been practicing, reflecting on these things and getting to know myself over time. Actually, it doesn't take too much time, but it's something that it's important to do every day. So you're building up this different, new, meaningful awareness of yourself. And because you then, and that then becomes more natural to you than simply being a kind of an awareness that I am a product of what other people think of me. It takes a little time, but the practice is essential, and practice with that aim or intention. And as you practice it more, you then feel that inner strength builds up. And what's very interesting, when people have been practicing this, maybe just for a couple of weeks, you know, they'll come back and tell you, well, it was so interesting. Without any effort, I just didn't react. I was surprised at myself. And so because the consciousness has shifted, or the awareness has shifted, it just becomes different because everything depends upon your awareness inside. So really, if you practice this every day, and especially at the beginning of the day, and I know that from Inner Space, there are plenty of resources on the website and so on for the reflections and different things you can look at, but a daily practice at the beginning of the day especially. So it's like, you know, some say the mind's like a crazy horse. Well, if you put the reins on in the morning, then you can ride the horse. So first thing in the morning, last thing in the evening, so that you wrap up the day and come back to yourself. And in between, we have a practice. You can say it's just a minute, you know, take a minute every hour. And it's not as difficult as it seems. And just a minute, only a minute, just a minute to just come back to yourself. And that gives productivity to the other 59 minutes and stability and centeredness. So you do need to put in a bit of that practice, but it becomes natural. And you'll see your reactions decreasing. It's not that you'll stand there and say, I mustn't react. The practice of building up that awareness automatically means your reactions change. I hope that's helped. So in a way, this isn't about a technique as such. It's really about shifting your awareness of yourself, which is a deeper thing, actually.
Thank you. Mm. The next question, the person who's posted the question is saying, thank you, that's really helpful. So that's answered that one. Mm. The next question is, you mentioned patience mm. and the importance of patience.
Mm.
How do you develop patience?
No, there's that saying, isn't there? God, give me patience, but hurry up. again, it comes with awareness, but it is something you can practice. And, you know, there are often, just initially as a practice, there are often times when you have to wait, right? And, or maybe you're traveling, or you have to wait in a queue. And I think now with social distancing, we're all going to have time in queues a lot more, even for our shopping and so on. Now, I can just get out my phone, oh, I've got to do this. Or I can think, oh, look at the time. When is this going to, how long is this going to be? Da, 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 da. And so I'm stressing myself. Maybe we can take the time, and I know I've practiced this actually, to say, okay, can I think about something meaningful, something productive? Maybe look at the other people, maybe think about what they're going through, maybe give them some good vibrations. Our thoughts carry vibrations. Maybe think about some good things that I've heard during the day. Maybe think about how I can show some kindness, something good, something uplifting. And I give myself patience. I say, it's okay. I can use this time to strengthen myself with positivity inside. And then, yes, maybe I want to get the phone out and do something, but it's not because I'm escaping. And this is the thing. We become impatient because we're escaping from something. So patience means I'm present. And if something doesn't come to me right away and I have to wait, and sometimes I may have to wait a long time. I may have to wait years for something. But I have to say to myself, if something is right, it will come to me and it will happen. And so let me be patient and let me trust that. If it isn't right, it won't come to me and I'll get to understand. But if it's right, it will come to me, whatever it is in life. So in the bigger picture or standing in a queue, let me always think about how I can use my time productively, consciously. And that helps us to be patient. And, you know, atmosphere is everything. If I'm in a queue and I'm a little bit impatient, you know, the other people around you get antsy as well. But if you're very calm, it has an effect on others. It's interesting. I had a very interesting example. It was one time traveling to India, and the check-in was very late opening, and it was a flight where you had to change. So the initial flight from here to London to Milan, there's no way they board people in time for it to take off in time for it to catch the Bombay flight. So when the counter opened, everybody just rushed, you know, falling over themselves. I just stood there. I said, there's no point. Let me just be patient. Let me see what happens. And somebody came up to me and said, are you traveling on your own? I said, yes. And she said, would you like to come on a direct flight to Bombay on British Airways instead? And I looked around me and I wondered, did anybody else need it? But everybody was caught up. So I said, yes. And I got to Bombay a lot sooner than I would have. So sometimes patience has its productive elements. That was an experience.
Thank you. The next question is, I love and appreciate this idea of doing one task at a time. However, how can I focus on one thing at a time when my partner needs my attention, the children also are clamoring for attention, I have my boss or my mother on the phone, and the dog gets excited and decides to add to the excitement and needs attention? How then do you focus on one thing at a time?
I'm so tempted to say move house, but that wouldn't be the... Yeah, sure, you're in that situation. You just need to stay calm. And actually, don't try to fulfill everybody's needs at once, because you just can't. And so when people, and I'm often in that situation, probably not with, quite those ingredients, but perhaps different ingredients, people expect you, can you do this? Why don't you do that? You know, pulling you here and there. And I find at those times, I just stay quiet for a few moments. I stay calm. And I just, if what's the most excitable, if it's the dog, okay, calm the dog down. If it's the children, whatever. And I just need to say, yeah, I'll be there. Just a moment. Just give them some reassuring feeling. Because if you feel pulled and they all want a part of you, you'll be split into pieces. And your anxiety at trying to do that will make them more volatile. And so give them some calming words. Yes, I'm just coming. Just give me a moment. Or why don't you do that? You'll find a way. If you're calm inside, you'll find the right thing to do or the right thing to say that would just keep things cool. And actually, more than anything, it's creating that calm atmosphere, especially in the home. And I've been with people who are very, very calm, and I see how they absolutely transform the atmosphere around them. And sometimes this person I'm speaking of is my mentor, she's a very wonderful person. And sometimes I go to her with a list of questions, and then she just asks me to be calm, and then she say, okay, now, what do you want to ask? And I would have forgotten. She's calmed me down so much. And so then I got into the habit of noting the questions down so that I could ask them. But by the time I asked them, I was very calm. So I was able actually to hear her answer much better, or to respond and to discuss. So it's the whole thing of where we respond, and we become a slave to the situation, and we lose hold of our conscious thinking and being. And then that adds to the chaos. So that's what we have to try. And you'll find people will get used to it, that you're not going to jump, because you can't just jump at everything. It's like this morning, the person asking me, well, have you done this? Okay, yes, I'm going to do it now. And because I was calm, they didn't argue with me. But if I'd said, it's too much, they would have said, well, go and do it, would have been a whole different interaction. Not easy. But coming back to the practice, that's what I would say. So creating that atmosphere at home is really important.
Thank you. The next question. What if the thing that's distracting you is your own mind? There are times my mind just seems to jump around everywhere and I'm not able to focus. At that time, how do I focus and do one thing at a time, or have one thought at a time?
Okay, when the mind, well, one thing, I go back to the daily practice, which helps and gives you strength. But of course, even in the practice, the mind is going to be jumping around, isn't it? And so if the mind's jumping around, sometimes I have to just become the observer and talk to my mind. I've done this. Talk to my mind, or it's a little bit like talking to yourself. And I say, okay, mind, you're thinking about all these things. Okay. All right, mind. Okay, Maureen, sometimes I use my name. Just calm down. Just take things step by step. That self inner talk is really helpful, I find. And so instead of again feeling a slave to something, as soon as I say, okay, mind, I can see what you're doing. I can see that you're anxious. What can we do about it? Can I remember that calm, that peace I have inside? Okay, everything's going to be okay. You know, you reassure your mind. So this kind of self-talk starts to turn things around. It may not happen instantly. Again, patience. You may need to do it a few times. But eventually, things begin to shift. So you have to start on that road of talking to your own mind, cajoling your own mind, and giving it love. Don't battle with it. Because when your mind is doing different things, why, you know, we tend to battle with our mind, and then the negative thoughts become stronger. You're giving it energy. But when you give the mind, I understand, it's a good mind, just going out of kilter at the moment, but you have a positive feeling towards the mind, which is this precious energy that can really serve you so well, then things begin to shift. It's really, of course, about our attitude towards ourselves. We're saying our mind, but it's towards ourselves. So these are the things, but self-talk is really important. But also sometimes, you know, just very practical things. And for me, when things feel too much, I just sit down and I'll have a cup of green tea. I love my green tea. And so just to sit there, have that cup of green tea, and I know this is what I'm doing right now. Everything else can wait. Or you'll have other things that you do. Even give yourself 5-10 minutes to take time out. It really, really helps. And everything else will be there when you come back to it. Doesn't matter. They can live with, your worries can live without you for 10 minutes. But of course, you would have calmed yourself, talked to yourself. So these are some of the things you can do.
Thank you. And the last question this evening is, how to juggle with the mental health of a family member?
Ah, yeah. This is not an easy one at all, absolutely. And of course, it depends on the situation. And of course, getting whatever help that is needed professionally, and I'm sure that's happening. And of course, when things go on over time, it can be very, very wearing. And so I absolutely have to keep my own practice very firm and very sound in the morning and the evening. I have to find that space to give myself time to strengthen myself inside. Otherwise, it's going to wear me down. And when I strengthen myself inside, it's possible to have a more, not that you're not compassionate, but to be more understanding, or for that understanding to come to the fore more. And sometimes you realize that there's very little that you can do or say. And of course, when the person's going through something, it's distressing to see them go through something. But I have to say to myself, and I remember it wasn't so much a mental health situation, but I've had that too, actually, in the family. But it was a situation where somebody was terminally ill, And of course, the tendency is to get drawn in and that you get into the sorrow of the situation. And one day I sat myself down and I said to myself, what is the best thing I can do for this person? Because I was very close to her. And I was surprised at the answer that came. The best thing you can do is to stay happy. Now, of course, I'm happy that you're going. It's not like that. But it was a signal to me that what the person needed was the atmosphere of my inner contentment and calm. As I say, not easy, but it's about separating out what it is that I have to do. They are doing what they have to do, and they often can't help it. It's a compulsion inside. I understand that. But I forget often what it is that I have to do. So that little bit of separation, and I begin to see what I have to do. And at the very least, it's staying calm. And not being fearful or distressed by their reactions, because the reactions will continue. I have to understand that. And also not to expect things to suddenly change. That's very important, because we so want the person to be better. We always have that hope that it's going to change. Sit with it, live with it. Don't put that pressure on yourself or the other person. And that actually helps things to shift. So that's another thing. These are not easy. Definitely not easy, but just giving some pointers that maybe you can try. And yes, do some meditation, take up some meditation commentaries, you know, really benefit yourself so that you can create that atmosphere for the other person.
Thank you, Maureen. Thank you very much, and good night.
Thank you. Good night, everyone. Thank you.